your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a really fine guest with us this evening. He's been with us before. Name is Patrick Wood. He's the author of Technocracy Rising. He has a website, Technocracy News and Trends. And also, he's a co-author of a past book called Trilaterals Over Washington, D.C. Welcome to our program, Patrick Wood.
Thanks, George. Good to be back.
Well, I tell you what, you are in the middle of a lot of things that have to do with technocracy. Is that right?
Well, you might say that.
I mean, you were way ahead, and now all of this stuff is beginning to hit, isn't it?
It really is. What can I say? I've been writing about technocracy now and relating it to the Trilateral Commission, by the way. But I've been writing about it now for several years, and of course, my book came out a little over 2 years ago. That was Technocracy Rising,
right.
The Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. And up to that point, a lot of people that read my book said, oh, it's great. It's the research. It's just impeccable. It connects all the dots. And they kind of walked away from it after that. Many people just said, well, it's a great book, but, I got to get on with my life. So, hey, we'll see you later. But now, just earlier last month, and on the 10th of the month, a new book was released by a global scholar by the name of Parag Khanna. And his book is called Technocracy in America, Rise of the Infostate. And let me tell you, he's no friend of America, and he is proposing that America adopt a system of direct technocracy.
Oh, my gosh.
In other words, he has pulled all the stops out, George, and he is talking openly now. He's doing radio interviews all over the place. He's on major media. He's talking to the World Economic Forum. He's talking all over, down to Singapore, and London, got everywhere. This guy is just, his name pops up everywhere if you look for it. And he's calling for a direct technocracy to be imposed in America. Radical stuff, George. He's talking about dissolving the Senate, for instance. He's talking about getting rid of the presidency, for instance, and having a committee of presidents, like maybe six or seven co-presidents that would rule by committee instead.
And my gosh.
George, you look at this stuff and I say, guys, I'm still hopping up and down out here in Arizona, right? I live in the Phoenix area.
Right.
And I'm hopping up and down saying, listen to me. We laid this out years ago and now this guy's doing it. Will anybody pay attention? And you know what, George, since he brought this book out, not only have my own book sales kind of, gone down a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit, but readership on technocracy.news, the traffic to the website has also decreased slightly in the last 30 days. Now, that you'd expect, January is always January, February, terrible months anyway.
Right.
For anybody. But still, I'm thinking to myself, what on earth am I doing wrong here? Is it my breath? Is it, do I have nose hairs? I mean, what is it that people will not listen and pay attention to the clear truth of this whole thing? They just don't get it. And what's unfortunate is that so many people are listening to this guy because he's saying that democracy is broken in America. Just look at the president we just elected, he says. tech. He says democracy is broken, so what we need is we need direct technocracy. Let the experts run everything.
Right. You know, that theme has been reiterated and repeated year after year at the World Economic Forum as far as the democracy needs to be revamped or reorganized. That theme has been a recurring theme, I noticed, at the World Economic Forum for several years.
It has. But now the gloves have been taken off, and technocracy is called what it should be. I said from the beginning, people would question me, well, why do you use the word technocracy? Why don't you just call it sustainable development? Well, the reason I insist on using the word technocracy is it's historically accurate.
Yes.
That's what it is. And words matter. And so I said, no, I'm using the word technocracy. I'm not going to call it anything else. The United Nations and all the people that are chasing after sustainable development, green economy, and all that kind of stuff, they're a big pack of plagiarists. They stole the idea from the technocrats of the 1930s, and they relabeled it, they repackaged it, and they claim it as their own, as if they invented something really new and neat, and it isn't new and neat, and it's, you know, they're just a pack of liars, basically. But finally, somebody like Kana has come out and said, oh, it's really technocracy.
I
say thank you, right. Parag Khanna. You know, you call it what it is. It's technocracy. Now let's get down to the business of analyzing technocracy, having some kind of a national discussion to see, is this really what we want? Or is this just, you know what?
Right. He has been in attendance and been schooled and been educated by the globalists on the major schools and foundations that I've noticed. And when I went back and looked at his history and schooling and so forth, is that accurate to say?
Well, it is. Georgetown University for his undergrad and master's, and then he went to the London School of Economics for his PhD. You can't get any more elite than that.
Right.
I think that's just the epitome of eliteness. And now he's a senior research fellow down at the U School for Public Policy in Singapore, which is one of the top globalist think tanks in the world.
Right.
In fact, there are three members of the Trilateral Commission on their board, whatever you call it, the board of trustees. So it's a globalist school, and he's one of the darlings there. He's a rising star in academia. And people love him. I liken him to a Zbigniew Brzezinski. I think he's that brilliant.
You think he's an extension of, well, the tech, you sort of renamed that technotronic era to technocracy era. I thought that was a pretty good insight.
Well, it's an accurate insight.
Yes, it is. It is.
You know, Brzezinski found himself as a professor at Columbia University when he wrote that book.
Yes, yes. Right. And you're saying that the Rockefellers and Brzezinski founded the Trilateral Commission together.
They did.
And you're saying that it's just a reiteration in your way of thinking of technocracy in general, but to elevate it to a worldly type of agenda and so forth. Would that be correct?
That's right, and that's what my book Technocracy Rising was all about, to document those links and connections between the early founding of the Trilateral Commission and technocracy as it made its way into the United Nations. It was spoon-fed by members of the Trilateral Commission to the United Nations. They repackaged it and call it sustainable development.
Right. You said once in a footnote that I picked up from your publication or so forth, the communitarian movement got into our churches. Is that what you were trying to say at one of those end notes in your book?
Well, I did. As a matter of fact,
elaborate a little bit on that. Yeah, Peter Drucker figures into this. Tell us about that. That's interesting.
Well, Peter Drucker really invented the category of work called a management consultant. He was the first one, and he infiltrated or impacted every major corporation in the world. I can't even remember how many books he wrote. The guy was prolific. he was an innovator of just the highest degree. And so He ended up consulting for business practices and stuff, all the major corporations of the world. And Druckerism, as it became known, is he was a champion for this philosophy called communitarianism.
Right.
And the idea of communitarianism is that you're only as good as the whole that you belong to. And so, you know, everybody's place in the world is a member of a greater whole, of a greater good. And so you should act and behave as a pack, as you know, whatever suits the greater good of man or greater group of your good of your organization, that's what you should do. And communitarianism was not exactly communism, but it had a lot of similarities to it. And Drucker was had a view of society that society needed to be completely transformed, as well as the corporate world did. And so he infiltrated or became friends with a major pastor from Texas. Well, not a pastor, but a guy from Texas who was supposedly a Christian. And they got together and they started a number of organizations over the years and stuff to promote Druckerism into the church. And many of today's mega pastors, or at least several of today's mega pastors, got their start by being mentored by this team in the early, you know, back in the 1980s.
Okay.
And so communitarianism, which has to do with the communities, right?
Right, right.
With building communities of people, as it made its way into churches, what happened is that the pastors that were called perhaps to be pastors legitimately, who had a heart for people at initially, individuals and stuff, they were in a very subtle way, they got converted from being a pastor into being a community organizer.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's what President Obama was, a community organizer. He was never a pastor, by the way. I'm probably certain he was a Muslim all of his life. But he was a community organizer. And this is what many pastors have become around our country today. They have ceased to be concerned for the spiritual welfare of individuals.
Yes, yes.
And now they are out organizing their communities for the good of the communities. They're doing all the social work. Trying to reform, if you will, their city culture.
Right. It's become a humanistic movement within the churches of man-centered versus God-centered, and then setting aside the individual and having the community have priority, and that is above and over the individual. Does that sound correct?
No, that's exactly what it is.
Okay.
It's communitarianism mixed.
Yeah.
With the church.
Right.
And so a lot of these, if not most of these big emerging churches, as they call it, the emerging church or the emergent church.
Right.
These organizations are ones that have been filled with this Drucker philosophy from the 80s. Now, Drucker has passed away since then.
Right.
But one of his early disciples and most advocate, greatest advocate of this thing, was the pastor Rick Warren of Saddleback Church that wrote the Purpose Driven series of books.
Yes.
And he was a lifelong friend of Peter Drucker, and he was just instrumental in almost everything that Peter Drucker did after he first got involved with the church. But by Drucker's own admission, by the way, he was not a Christian.
Okay.
He said it openly.
Yeah.
He said he was just looking for to create the third leg of his famous three-legged stool analogy.
I see. Well, you know, many people call communitarianism. Now, Nikki Rapana out of Alaska, I don't know if you're familiar with her. She pioneered in revealing communitarianism with a big book with her daughter, Nordica. And it's online available. And she's since then elaborated, further on that subject. But that first came to my attention about 6-7 years ago. So I've been after this communitarianism for a while, see. And then when the Agenda 21 came along, that's it right there. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And so it's just flowering now and being instituted and it's manifesting and so forth in a lot of, on a lot of levels now. But I knew that you had quite an insight when you put that in your end notes about humanitarianism. Because I've been studying, you know, like humanism versus humanitarianism. You know, see what I mean? But the churches have been converted over to a very, humanism type of view, it looks like.
It is. And you see, and I happen to be watching a couple of churches very closely right now, listening to, you know, the archive videos of sermons and stuff like that. I have seen this up close and personal where churches, where formerly evangelical churches that were deeply involved with the lives of the people in the church, now they're organizing all these community events with other churches. It's kind of like an interfaith movement within a city. They're getting together with all the different church organizations and stuff, many of which have absolutely nothing in common with their, you know, with their approach to, you know, pastorhood and whatever. And, you know, they're trying to do programs together, work together with these other organizations to transform their cities into better communities. And that's just that is just pure communitarianism, 100% communitarianism, and it's pure Druckerism as well, because that's what he preached, and that was the outcome that he hoped would happen, and is happening all over the country today.
Right. You know, recently President Trump made at his prayer breakfast speech, he seemed to, of course, he talked about Schwarzenegger, but also he talked about the Johnson Amendment. And the Johnson Amendment was put forward by Lyndon B. Johnson. And what it had to do was it shut down those churches in being active in political activities. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It made it, or otherwise they would lose their tax-free status from the IRS, see? He was getting static in this area. I'm from Austin, and of course, LBJ, we knew him real well. But he was getting static and resistance from many of the mainline churches in the 50s to re-election. And so he put that Johnson Amendment forward to quieten them down, to muzzle them, actually, within their churches, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Trump is pretty smart. He brought that up, see. Mm-hmm. I noticed the mainline press, though, dwelled upon the Schwarzenegger comparison, you know, on the Apprentice program, like, you know, Trump is still that ego, you know. Now, that gets me back. I need to ask you this question. Mm-hmm. Recently, you know, we've had this immigration thing. It should have been better organized. It wasn't. But also, there have been some things that Nikki Haley said recently yesterday at the UN about a real hard right stance against Russia. Do you think that his foreign policy hasn't settled out yet? What do you think?
Well, it hasn't, and I'm just kind of watching this, scratching my head a little bit about why the consistent hatred of Russia, if you will. I don't know, hatred is not the right word, but there's this aggression, this mental aggression towards Russia. We saw it before the election took place in the left. We saw everybody from Bernie Sanders to Hillary Clinton to John Podesta, everybody's blaming the Russians for having skewed the election. And they were Obama was like ready to go to war with the Russians.
We're seeing that come out of the Bilderberg group, Patrick. That's came out of them in the last couple of years. This hard right and sanctions against Russia. And then the movement of this NATO group, these brigades into far eastern Poland right up against Russia, is threatening to Russia. And they're paranoid anyway, see?
Yes, they are. And so before the election, President Trump was very, he kind of had a firm stance with Russia, but nevertheless, I remember him now as being conciliatory. And
we wanted
to bring Russia into the fold rather than to push them away and make them an enemy. Now, that stood out as a diplomatic policy that might have come into the State Department, but it hasn't so far. And now that we see Nikki Haley making statements like this in a public body like the United Nations, bringing back that hardline, mentality towards Russia, what this is telling me is this is an agenda that's much bigger. than either political players, left or right.
I think so. You know, another point to make, too, that's interesting with Nikki Haley is when she first addressed, made her first address to the United Nations, she said, you're either with us or against us, not quite those words.
Right.
But in the end, she said, we're taking names. It was threatening, you know, to the General Assembly. I mean, in a diplomatic setting, that is not the wordage to use.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean? And so that gave me, my ears pricked up on that. And then yesterday when she said she tied the sanctions to Crimea, by the way, and a hard line, right, you know, and with what Trump has said on the campaign trail and so forth, and then his he's going he wanted to join in with Russia there in Syria, you know, to try to settle that.
Yep.
And I don't, there's counter currents here. Say what I mean.
There is, and let me tell you, I have no idea who's listening to this program.
Right.
And I'll step out on a limb here, but I'll say this, and I think you're going to catch on immediately.
Right.
To what I'm going to suggest, but I've watched these people for a long time, George. You know that.
Sure,
right?
I have too.
I smell Henry Kissinger.
Yes, yes. He chummed up with him in New York.
Yes, he did.
And but Kissinger did say he had a friendlier demeanor towards the Russians than Brzezinski. Brzezinski is that hard line right against the Russians, even though he's on the liberal democratic side of the politics. Now, go ahead, expand on what
I know. Well, you're right.
Brzezinski
really hated the Russians.
he hates them. I mean, and the whole policies about moving those troops in to eastern Poland, everything, this is all Brzezinski stuff, you know?
Yeah, I know.
But now Kissinger, what I see is they've surrounded Trump. You see what I mean?
That's right.
You've got the neocons in there, even though he fired Nealon, there's controversy about whether she quit. Well, you know, she was Victoria Nealon was the one that upseated on that military coup in Ukraine.
Uh-huh.
And then Joe Biden's son is in there with oil and gas interests now in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
I mean, these people, they plunder countries, you know? I mean, none of them are any good, you know?
I know.
It makes me think, though, that is Trump taking some of this advice and hardening his stance against Russia? Because one thing that came out just recently, okay, was I think Jerome Corsi published an article recently about this anti-global foundation, this Russian foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying that they were involved in putting forth demonstrators on the ground in Chicago that caused violence at the Trump rally up there.
Mm.
But now we have Veritas O'Keefe with hidden cameras going in there and outing the fact that the Democratic National Convention committee was in there employing some of their closely held colleagues to foment violence against Trump's at that rally.
So
then what I'm saying, this Carsey article recently seemed to indicate that the Russians were funding a disruption of Trump's rally, but I don't see that. Okay.
I
don't see it because what is happening here more than anything else is that what they're fighting over is they're still trying to hide the secret of money creation and the dominance and the monopoly of money creation through the ownership of their central banks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, what they're doing here is that over the ages, they have been funding the liberal left socialist communist movement. Okay. The Fabian was an earlier support of that. And then, but they've never let the liberal left know about the money secrets. The money secrets came in from that hard right, see what I mean? And didn't come in from the left. And now I think people are beginning to wake up to the Fed being privately owned and other things. And they're fighting off those kinds of ideas. And I think that's what the real struggle is behind the scenes here. Okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
Not all these groups are aware of these issues, see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They haven't been for a very long time.
But they've been, what it is basically, and this is what you see, like I was reviewing a book called Culture Wars, The Struggle to Define America, written by James Davison Hunter. But these academicians are stuck in those boxes, those box diagrams too much. See, they leave out two important things. They leave out the secret society influence and the money secrets in their final analysis in these books. If you leave those two things out, then you're not going to get close to the truth of the power system here.
That's right. You got to follow the money.
Yeah, you got to follow the money, but you have to know about secret societies. You have to put into this occultism too. You got to know how that figures in, because the occultism will lead you to the pedophilia and all that other horrible stuff. See what
it does? Yeah.
So anyway, that's sort of what I see now. Now you're saying Kissinger's hand is in here. Is what you're saying?
Well, I'm just smelling it. I can't prove it, but he has been chummy with Trump and vice versa.
Yes, he has.
Several people that are kind of in the know have called Kissinger the foreign policy advisor for Russia. And you know, I mean, you look at it, where there's smoke, there's probably fire.
You think they're pressuring Trump through Kissinger, using Kissinger to pressure Trump into a much more traditional relationship of foreign relations?
It makes me wonder if the pressure is getting to Trump already. Well, this wouldn't be good, because he's only in office now for what, 3 weeks or 2 weeks?
Well, two weeks today.
Wouldn't be good at all.
He's been in office two weeks today. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, I would see the Russian announcement now by Nikki Haley as being a little check mark. You know, we're not gonna throw him out for that, right?
Right.
So let's watch. We need to keep our ears open and find out what's really going on here. Where's this anti-Russian thing coming from all of a sudden? And, cause we see that as just a continuation of the anti-Russian that happened before the election. And then the next thing that comes up, that I find curious is that on one hand, Trump is going to said he's going to move the embassy in Tel Aviv to Jerusalem,
right?
Which, of course, would be somewhat of a stick in the eye to the Palestinians and the other Arab nations.
Exactly.
Which I have no problem with, by the way. But you go from there to what he said yesterday. I saw this headline come through that the Trump administration, didn't say Trump himself, but the Trump administration had warned Netanyahu in Israel.
Yes, I saw that.
To stop talking about the settlements, about new settlements.
Yes, I saw that.
Built. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it said in the same article that that Trump will continue to pursue a two-state solution in Israel, which definitely means giving up land on Israel's part to create such a two-state. This has been a doctrine, been around for 45, 50 years now. And Trump said pretty plainly beforehand that he wasn't going to engage the two-state option for Israel. But
right
now, that's a crack. Okay, he's flip-flopped on that. Now they're saying, well, you know what, we're still pushing for a two-state solution. We need to, you know, Israel needs to do something here, you know, to make it more conciliatory so we can talk peace with the Palestinians, et cetera. And so that's kind of a flip-flop as well. That's not enough in itself maybe to throw them out either. But I'm getting concerned that some other influence is coming in and putting pressure on Trump to modify his stance.
Well, Jared Kushner is his son-in-law, okay?
That's right.
And that's where some of it's coming from, I think, okay?
It could be.
And these other people, there's too many Goldman Sachs people there, okay? Mm-hmm. Just too much.
Absolutely.
And I just see that that they're together. They're beginning to manage him back to a more traditional hard stance against Russia and those sanctions. Then
right.
Today it was announced he's going to impose sanctions against Iran.
Yeah.
Okay. And then our newly appointed Secretary of State, what's his name?
Tillerson.
Yeah. He was saying things that is, you know, examination hearings or whatever, very threatening things about the South China Sea to the Chinese. Then way before that, Trump was talking to the Taiwan president. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a hodgepodge here of foreign policy that's contradictory. And yes. I don't know where it's coming from. You know what I'm trying to say? Exactly.
That's exactly right. So we have to really watch this carefully in the next 2 or 3 months to see if he's just going to be another establishment guy and doing the establishment things or not.
I think the best we can hope for is some of the promises are being carried out now. They didn't want demising of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
That's right.
That is a huge thing. We're gonna get some things that we wanted in this first 100 days. After that, I don't think we can ask for much, or much will happen.
Okay? We'll see. We won't have long to wait on that. But, and I am glad that he canned the TPP, that he's withdrawn from it. It doesn't mean he couldn't bring it back in some other iteration. He could.
Right.
But for now, it's dead. For now, the Transatlantic Investment and Trade Partnership is dead as well.
But this Chow lady, you know, didn't you bring that up one time? We talked last time.
Which now?
This Chow, you know, this.
Yes, Elaine Chow. That's
yeah,
right.
Elaine Chow, you know, yeah. And she what they concern. Were gonna. You've got an excellent article here on public-private partnerships that you posted.
Yeah.
And I sort of wanted to touch on that too, and of course they were going to run that thing through East Texas from all the way from Mexico, you know. And it would have eaten up a lot of land in Texas too. See?
Yes.
And then they were going to have a monopoly of the commercial in that corridor too.
That's
okay.
Right.
I mean, these people won't. They nothing is. They want everything. You know what I mean?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
And so now you made a comment during our last conversation about. Let's see here. About cashless society, Stiglitz, Joseph Stiglitz, okay?
Oh, yeah.
And I happen to have that clip. I'd like to play it so we can, our listening audience can listen to it. And then we just sort of comment a little bit on this cashless society that's coming up, okay?
Yes, do it.
I believe very strongly that for countries like the United States, we could and should move to a digital currency and get rid of currency. And I have a paper, an NBR paper, coming out on using digitalizing and electronic money so that you would have the ability to trace this kind of corruption. There are important issues of privacy and issues of cyber security, but it would have certainly very big advantages. And I think you could attack some of the cyber issues because of the transparency. The other point is on Trump. Just if I recall correctly, he actually opposed the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act because he said, you know, it's one of the dimensions in which you compete is by corruption. I think that represents exactly the kind of stance that we should be against, as so many of his other stances, and that this is not the way to do business.
Okay. Did you get that, Patrick?
Yeah, I sure did.
So Trump was at odds with him on this. You know, he's not going along with this cashless society, see?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of interesting that in a way there. Now, this Stiglitz guy, he also said, I wanted to play that because that's from the horse's mouth. You know what I mean?
Sure is.
The other thing that he maintained at one of his other panel discussions was that the single monetary unit was a mistake for the European Union. What do you think?
The European Union had to last for as long as it did. It is tending to disintegrate right now, but the reason this cashless thing is coming to the discussion all over the planet, not just in Europe, is that a cashless society will take care of all currency problems in the world. It'll take care of currency manipulation. It'll take care of which we've been accused of, and we accuse Russia of, and China of. It will take care of all of the fluctuations as well in current and the values of currency. And so, if they can achieve this cashless society, they're going to basically do, in their mind, I'm sure this is what they're thinking, they're going to do away with a host of problems, including weaknesses in the central banks right now, where many of them are on the verge of bankruptcy. Actually, they're technically bankrupt, but they just haven't said so. So the whole financial system has huge trouble right now that they can't, they can only spin so many plates at a time on a stick, and they reached a limit. I think they know that. And so now they're calling for these radical things, these radical changes to take place, in their mind, thinking this is going to fix our problem and it will take us on down the road.
Right, right. This cashless society, now they pulled the rupee, the 1,000 rupee bill in India and the 500 rupee bill. Have you heard? I've heard that it hasn't been that successful because the villagers don't have accounts. What do you think?
Well, they don't, but they're forcing them to get accounts.
I got you. Yeah.
If you want to live, you're going to have to get an account. That's basically what they told them. And,
right.
You know, it doesn't matter if they come willingly or forcibly. The point is, you get an electronic ID on them, and once you do, then you've got them. You've got control over them. It creates a digital dictatorship over the people that...
It's automatic taxes, too, and inbelling and all that.
Well, that too, but yeah. Technocracy, back to technocracy, and technocracy
right.
demands massive surveillance over the social machine that it intends to manage. And so you have to know who's in the system. You have to know what their strengths and weaknesses are, what their what their habits are, whether they're smart or stupid or whatever. Or ignorant or educated, technocracy wants to know every conceivable detail of your life. Even down to the molecular and DNA level, they want to know everything. And that's what this cashless move will do. It will force everyone into the system to get an electronic ID on them. And once they do that, then they'll have them under their control. They'll be able to control them to move left, right, up, down, whatever they want to. And in the case of an unwilling person that comes in and says, look, I never had a bank account before. I've always done business in cash. The government's just going to say, okay, here is your plastic card with your number on it. It all of a sudden becomes a national ID as well.
Right.
They give them the card. They said, this is your card, and your food stamps will be deposited on this card every month, and you must go to the store, use this card to get your benefits or whatever the case is. And they'll say, okay, because they want to eat.
Right, and it's convenient too, isn't it?
Well, it's so convenient.
And they'll give you those little discounts. You know, there's a grocery store here in Austin that you have a card and they'll discount it, okay?
Yeah.
And they have the little stickers on there. So I got the card, you know, I get the discount. You know, but I've been using these, you know, debit cards and stuff for years now. And so we're falling into it, aren't we, huh?
Well, in a sense, we just haven't had any choice. But
yeah.
You see, there's still, and even in America, there's still 20 to 25% of Americans who are not in the banking system at all.
Oh, okay.
For
okay.
one reason or another, they're just not. And you'll see the language all the way through original technocracy documents, all the way into sustainable development, United Nations, whatever. You'll see this phrase appear everywhere, and the phrase is, no person left behind. It's
right.
all over their literature, no person left behind. They want everybody in the system because they cannot manage society if there's 20% of us running around doing our own thing. It won't work. They have to have everybody, 100% of the people in the system, tagged, punched, numbered, and identified in order for their crackpot technocracy system to work.
Right.
That's
right.
It. They have
right.
to have them in the system. So in America, that 20 to 25% will be forced back into the system. And of course, they're blaming it on corruption and drug money and, you know.
Well, that's what Stiglitz was saying. That's this corruption bill that Trump wouldn't go along with, right?
That's so stupid. I hate to use gutter language. That is so stupid, George, because if there's any criminals here in this picture, the criminals are the banksters who have stolen 99% of the value of our currency over the last 110 years.
Exactly.
That's where the criminals are.
Well, you know, I did a little research here recently. You know, when you go back to the National Monetary Commission, remember, this has preceded the Federal Reserve. Well, Senator Aldrich is involved on that, and his daughter married John D. Rockefeller's son.
That's right.
See, I mean, they're all entangled in this thing. See what I mean?
Can't get away.
this Graham fella, I forget his last name, but he was a newspaper muckraker, they called him, in New York City. Mm-hmm. Well, he outed Senator Aldrich's, there was scandal in the Senate, okay?
Yeah.
And Aldrich was the financier, you could say, of a lot of the big money in the country. Well, he had to quit, and then because of this series of articles, and then the newspaper columnist that wrote those, he died within 6 months. He was shot in New York City.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's amazing how they, you know, these scandals are unfolding, but they still got the Federal Reserve in 1913.
Yeah.
But you know what was also interesting? They appointed a committee to go throughout Europe and study these central banks and bring back those best of those ideas from Europe, you know. Uh-huh. And then they brought those ideas back, you know.
Right.
And then of course that culminated in the Fed being. But they at one time the banks came out against that Federal Reserve Act. Okay.
Right.
To make the public think that it was, you know, in favor of the people, right?
Right.
But before that, you had that big William Jennings Bryan. Remember that? The Cross of Gold speech?
Yep.
And there was great debate going on about money and stuff. So it's fascinatingly interesting.
It is. We follow the money. I think we're going to find in the next year or two that the central banking system is going to I think people are going to start suggesting that it's outlived its usefulness and it's time to change and go away from a central bank system.
Well, who's opening that up is they're saying things like we need to maybe move back that capitalism is archaic. Now we need to move back to state capitalism. But one of the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto is a central bank controlled by the government.
Yes, it is.
And so state capitalism is that exact same thing.
Well, it
that's
is.
What, that's it, what China it, has it now, yeah. today, see? Yeah. The Chi-coms or that yeah. example.
Yeah.
And I'm getting people looking, talking, the top elites in the world are talking about the Chinese model being a pretty good model, you know?
Well, they are.
See?
China, according to...
controlling people, yeah.
Farag Khanna blatantly calls China a technocracy, which they are. Singapore as well. He calls it probably the most advanced technocracy in the world.
Right.
But China has chosen to go down the technocracy road, and they are a nation led by experts, and they are seeking to create a sustainable development economic system in their country. That's a technocracy. So it's no wonder that the United Nations loves them, and it's no wonder that the Parag Khanas of the world loves them, and other elitists look to China and say, well, we need to be more like China. Oh, really? We really do, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, that was a mentality that killed how many hundreds of, tens of millions of people in the last century. It was not pretty. It was not pretty.
Right. Well, I did a lot of research on IG Farben, too, over the years.
Uh-huh.
And boy, they moved a bunch of industries, you know, the Auschwitz death camp, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They had 28 industries in there surrounding them. They were working people to death at those industries because they were far removed from bombing raids, see.
That's right. Yep.
But that IG Farben building, the building in Frankfurt was never bombed, okay?
Yeah.
So these top elites, whether it's the left, the right, the conservatives, the liberals, you know what I mean? They're all working together on some level because of the money. Like you said, follow the money, right?
That's right.
So they're tied together with the money system, the money power system, and the secret of money creation and the monopoly of money creation through crediting credit on sets of books.
Yes, yes. And the original person, I just have to inject this, the original person who discovered, who kind of discovered this whole, you know, global thing like this, where regardless of political parties and stuff, or who's in power, this country, that country, whatever, that there has been a thread of money transfer and money flows and stuff. And Anthony Sutton was the guy who really broke that whole thing open with his original technology series that he wrote back in the late 60s and early 70s.
Okay. Yeah, we got on to Anthony Sutton in about 1990, mm-hmm. and Eric Samuelson brought him that, you know, him to my attention. And so I virtually started reading all the books about Bolshevik and Wall Street and all that stuff back then, see.
Right.
But that's where, if we can teach people that the ultra capitalists have been funding the communist movement for their own system of control, then we might be able to make some progress here. But that's a hard one to get to sometimes.
Sure is.
See what I mean? Because it's antithetical to what they've been taught, see?
Yep.
The collective against the capitalist, the capitalist against the collective, see?
Yep.
And they created, it's false paradigm in a way, see?
Yeah, you always have to have an enemy, is what they say.
Yeah, you got to. Now, what about this University of California thing recently out there? Milo was going to speak out there, and he got the demonstrations against him. But did you see any of the video?
Oh, yeah.
I was watching the video the night it was unfolding. Mm-hmm. I got onto it pretty quick. What was your observations of watching the video? What were your impressions?
Well, I have a couple. You've got a bunch of thugs running around in a city that has been known by us who used to live in California as Berserkly.
Okay.
And Berkeley is famous for its riots. And it's interesting that it reminded me back what happened in the 60s.
Okay.
Where there was just unbridled rioting like that going on several campuses, but especially... seems like Berkeley always had the headline. They were just all kinds of stuff happened there. And in that case, back in the 60s, the police stood down, just like they did this time.
Yes.
They backed away, and they didn't do anything. I have no idea what their logic was for this again, but here's what comes across. If you say you have a cause, then doing any kind of criminal activity is okay. And you get a free pass. And so the police stood down. They didn't go in and arrest them. They didn't apply riot control to them or anything else. They did not stop the destruction of private property or even the assaults that took place on innocent people. They did nothing to stop that. And that sends a huge message to America that there are two standards of laws that we obey in America. One is for people who, quote unquote, have a cause, these radicals like this on the radical left. And honestly, I think some of the people might have been sincere that they did have a cause, but a lot of those people were paid thugs. They were paid provocateurs, agents provocateurs
yes,
that were sent
yes.
in
okay.
to make trouble and to fan up the flames, to break windows, to set things on fire, throw Molotov cocktails, and the establishment backed away from controlling them and busting them. They should have been busted. Every single one of them should have been busted and thrown in jail.
Right.
They deserve to have a criminal record for the rest of their life.
Right.
They really do. But they didn't do it. And it's also interesting, another thought I have.
Okay.
You know, we've seen how cowardly these terrorists are, these Islamic terrorists especially, that have come into our country, and they shot up this place or shot up that place.
Right.
The only place you see these people show up, George, is where there's a no-gun zone.
Yes, that's right.
Isn't that right? They show up.
I know,
Where they know they're not going to have any resistance, they know they're not going to have any trouble, and we see this with these riots as well that are happening. Some are big, some aren't so big, but we see it. They're not showing up in places where they're going to get. You know, like for instance, there hasn't been a riot down at Arizona State University in Arizona here, Tempe.
Okay.
There hasn't been a riot down in University of Arizona in Southern Arizona, and there hasn't been one in New Mexico, and there hasn't been one in Texas. And you know why? Because people there just wouldn't put up with that.
Right, right.
They would say, you're out of here. You're out of here, Buster. We're going to get you. And if I have to say, if that, maybe Austin would be different. I know Austin's a different place.
Yeah, Austin's a very, very, yeah, it's different, the profile here. Yeah, okay.
But if you had something like that happen in Dallas, you'd have a gang of bikers show up pretty
right.
quick with chains and baseball bats and function sticks, and they'd say, we're going to have ourselves a little riot here,
that's
boys.
That's the security, right? Well, you know, I've interviewed two of the founding members of the Rolling Thunder, okay, way back.
Yep.
And we were getting into the POW question. But I see the point that you're making. It's unfortunate. Anarchism, these anarchists are in there and with masks on, ski masks on, see? And whether some are being paid or not, that probably some are, some of the agent provocateurs. But then there's some very misled people, too, out there, you know?
Yeah, well, let me ask you a question. Where do all these protesters wearing the masks,
yeah.
They're all identical. If you didn't notice that, the masks
right.
are all identical.
Right.
What store did they go to?
Yeah, to the same store. Yeah, someone bought those masks and distributed them.
No kidding.
We had the same thing at some of these rallies that Trump, you know, not to the degree that occurred there in Berkeley the other night.
Yeah.
But yeah, the pattern is similar. Some talk show hosts that I've monitored over the years are talking about a color revolution underway already. What do you think?
I think we've seen a lot of precursor to that. Obviously,
okay.
I think, you know, President Obama did more to fire up racial hate than any president we've ever had in our history, and he did a good job. You know, you think of places like Ferguson and other places that they just fanned the fires of racial conflict, and it's still going on. The people that were behind it then are still out there. People like George Soros are still out there lathering money upon these radicals, encouraging them to go out and do what they're doing. So
right.
it's with us, and it's not, you know, unless somebody calls it out from the top, which I doubt is going to happen, but, you know, they're going to continue to do what they do. Now, maybe someday they're going to meet up with some real Americans. Like I said, you know, if the bikers go out there and said, you know what, we've had enough, you little pipsqueaks.
Yeah.
You little snowflakes. You know, little wimps. You know, this is America, and we're not putting up with this crap in America.
Yeah.
So you either clear the street, or we're going to clear it for you.
Right. Well, you know, this color revolution, Soros' hand is involved in this on one level or another.
Yes.
He was big in Ukraine in funding different groups that were hiding behind a facade of internationalism and election reform and democracy. You know what I mean?
That's right. And
this open society and all these very, very beautiful sounding plaudits. You know what I mean?
That's
but
right.
Behind the scenes, they were trying to revolt against the existing duly elected regimes like they did in the Ukraine.
Exactly right.
So it's interesting. And also, I've observed some stuff in Lithuania also along the same lines. I'm not going to broach those names right now on the air. It wouldn't be appropriate. But there's one person that got involved in certain elections that I was privy to that I didn't like at all, and so I went and drilled down in there, and it opened up a can of worms in Lithuania.
Uh-huh.
These things are these foundations and these movements and these institutions are very big. You know what I mean?
Yes, they are.
They're much larger than most people could ever imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were saying earlier that there's something behind there that's bigger, well, it is. It's a humongously organized system of rule, okay, that
yep.
we don't fully appreciate, okay?
Yep, I know. Somebody, it would be nice if somebody could pull back the curtain and expose the person that is pulling the levers. I know a lot of people have tried, but there's so much confusion and fake news floating around that that people on the street just don't know what to believe.
Right.
And they may have seen the truth somewhere float by their view, but they have no idea. They have no clue as to how to validate whether it's true or not. And right. So people just kind of, you know, just in one ear and out the other.
Right. We've got about 3 minutes left now. Why don't you tell us about your sites and what all, topics you cover and your website and all that. I have it up on the site, my site too, thesecrettruth.com. But elaborate a little bit about some of your latest going-ons.
Well, sure. Technocracy.news is the only website on the Internet today anywhere in the world that focuses on technocracy exclusively. And I curate stories from all over the world. I post at least 3 stories a day, so you can see it from the horse's mouth, like you said. And I make my own comments to help people put it in context, but I also write articles myself and post on here an analysis of technocracy. And you won't find anything like it anywhere. If you want to know about it, technocracy, that's where you will end up, I guarantee it. You can search on Google for it. You're going to see technocracy.news in the top on the first page. You'll see my book, Technocracy Rising, also available on the right side of that page. And my book is available on Amazon as well, Amazon.com. There's a Kindle version. People like to read on electronic readers. And you'll just find everything and anything and everything that relates to technocracy and how it's being implemented and introduced around the world. And I hope people will just go there and get on the mailing list to receive the daily digest of stories that get posted and get up to speed. There's no excuse not to get up to speed, really, since it's just right here. You can just get spoon-fed every morning, if you will, with the latest news on technocracy.
Well, that's good. I've been reading in your site for a couple of years now, however long you've had it up there, and it's very insightful. And are we not in the throes of culture wars in a way?
Oh my gosh!
But on
yes.
multiple levels of political, monetary, social, everything, aren't we? Huh?
Oh my goodness! Yes, and I've contended for a long time that we need to cut to the chase on this whole thing and get right down to what really is driving the world right now. And I just believe wholeheartedly it is technocracy. And I think pretty much anybody who's come to my site and gotten involved with his stories, gotten involved with my book and stuff, read it, they agree with me pretty quickly that technocracy is the clear and present danger to our nation and to the world.
Boy, I'll tell you what, I couldn't any more agree with you than that. You're right on top of it, and you've done so much, and you're a very dedicated person. I want to thank you for being with us this evening. And anyway, come on in to thesecrettruth.com, and you'll find this program, this interview, and also all the click-offs to get to his site. Thank you very much, Patrick Wood.
Thank you, George.
Okay, good night.
Good night. Thank you.